It's a drinking party in which Socrates and a bunch of friends have gathered at the home of Agathon, a real historical figure, a famous Athenian tragic poet, writer of tragedies for the stage. And the idea of the entertainment is that they're all going to stand up and give an impromptu speech in praise of Eros, the god of erotic sexual desire, love. Last time we went through most of the speeches. You heard the speech from Pausanias, and Phaedo, Erasimachus, and Aristophanes. Today, the main thing is to listen to Socrates' speech, which is perhaps the most interesting of all, but there's just a little speech that comes before it. Just before Socrates, Agathon, the host of the evening's entertainment, gives his speech in praise of Eros. Now, you remember last time we had Aristophanes. He's a famous comic poet, and you know, they liked comedy back then just as much as you do now. And I hope someday maybe you can read something by Aristophanes. It's not a chore. You don't have to be a classics major to want to read it. Read one called The Clowns. Socrates is an actual character. He puts Socrates on the stage, makes him do all kinds of ridiculous things. Aristophanes was this irrepressible comic. And yet, when you consider him personally, when now he's off the stage, in a closed room with his friends, speaking candidly, it turns out that he has a surprisingly tragic view of human life, and a tragic view of Eros, of love, of what it is, of why we pursue it, of what it can do for us. All very tragic. Agathon is the opposite. He's a writer of tragedies, who turns out to have a rather cheerful and optimistic view about love. When it's his turn to stand up and praise Eros, first thing he says is, Eros is the happiest of all the gods. He also says Eros is the most beautiful of all the gods. Eros is youthful, he's forever young, he loves the young, prefers the young, flees from the aged. He also says that Eros is a skilled poet, and the proof of Eros' skill in poetry is that Eros can make anybody a poet. Fall in love and you become a poet. To Agathon, that is the summit of wisdom. He doesn't think of wisdom the way Socrates does, as intellectual understanding. To him, artistry, the creation of beauty, is proof of wise knowledge. The wise are the creators, the inventors, the poets. Well, finally, Socrates rises to take his turn. And he says that back at the beginning, remember, none of them knew that this was coming. Agathon just explained to them when once they'd already gathered, this was his idea of what they should do. So when Agathon first proposed this, Socrates thought, well, that's a great idea. All these men, wise men, they're going to stand up and they're going to share with me their wisdom about this god Eros, and so I'll, you know, probably learn something, and that's good. Socrates thought, that the way that you praise someone, especially a god, is by saying knowledge about this god, telling the truth about this god. But that's the way to praise a god, to speak knowledgeably about its praiseworthy qualities. But now, Socrates says, he realizes that the speeches are really just an entertainment. They're not about the truth at all. Aristophanes had made the game obvious. The speeches create the appearance of praise without really praising the god at all. Well, Socrates doesn't want to do that. He wants to tell the truth and to praise in reality, not just in appearance and ironically. But he can't do that because he doesn't know anything, least of all anything true about the gods. All that he can do, all that he ever does, is question others. So instead of giving his own speech in praise of Eros, he begins to question the last speaker, Agathon. According to the speech of Agathon, Eros is happy, the most happy of all the gods. and beautiful, the most beautiful of all the women. So now Socrates begins to interrogate Agathon about those points. So in the usual Socratic way, he starts asking questions, and the answers are typically yes or no. Is love the love of something or nothing? He asks Agathon. Something or nothing? Something, of course. That means that love is a relation. It's directed out of the self toward another. Yes, Socrates, of course. What is it that drives us out to the other? Socrates asks Agathon, do we desire what we love or not? Of course, Socrates, we desire it. Does a lover need what he loves or not? He needs it, Socrates. Does a lover have what he desires? No, Socrates. When you have it, desire is over. So, Socrates says, love is desire for something we lack. We never love what we have. So Agathon was wrong to say that Eros is happy. One who desires lacks what would make him happy. So if Eros desires, he must be lacking, not happy. Eros isn't happy. Is he perhaps beautiful, as Agathon had argued? Well, Socrates asks, is it possible to love something ugly? No, Socrates. So a lover must love the beautiful. But that means that he lacks beauty himself, because we only love what we lack, not what we have. Therefore, Eros is not beautiful. So Agathon was wrong to say that Eros is happy, and wrong to say that Eros is beautiful. And Agathon cheerfully accepts this instruction from Socrates. It turns out, Socrates, that I didn't know what I was talking about in that speech. Now, he's still refusing, Socrates, to make a speech of his own. He says, I don't know anything about God. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you lies. First, he questions Agathon, let somebody else do the talking. He just asks questions. And then once that's over, he says, well, I wish I could tell you something about the gods, but I can't. But I will tell you a speech that I heard a long time ago by someone else about Eros. So he says, I'll tell you about a speech that I heard from a woman named Diotima. A Diotima is a wise woman, a priestess from Mantinae, whom Socrates knew years and years ago when he was young, and who instructed Socrates in the art of love. Now, all the conversation to this point has been entirely about men and about male love. It's been assumed that that kind of eros is the best and the purest form, with no need to consider feminine experience. Bringing in Diotima changes. And Socrates goes on to introduce several aspects of feminine experience, including pregnancy, birth, and the relationships of mother and grandmother. The very first thing that Diotima tries to do, now Socrates is telling his friends about this speech that he heard long time ago from Diotima, so he's still not saying anything himself, just what other people have said. The first thing that Diotima tried to explain to Socrates is that love is neither beautiful nor good. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that love is ugly and bad. What's not good doesn't have to be bad. What's not beautiful doesn't have to be ugly. There's an intermediate state, a condition between beautiful and ugly, between good and bad, likewise between wise and ignorant, between mortal and immortal. To be a spirit, to be spiritual, to be demonic, is to occupy this middle territory. Not a god, but not an animal either. Not wise, but not ignorant either. Not good, but not wicked either. That is the spiritual realm, in our translation, the demonic realm. And it's here in this intermediate, demonic, spiritual realm that Eros lives. This is what Diotima tells Socrates. Eros, she says, Eros is not a god, but a spirit like us, or at least like a philosopher, especially like Socrates. She instructs Socrates in the genealogy of Eros. Who are his forebears? Who are his ancestors? Where did he come from? This is what I put up here under my second point in my overhead. She says that Eros's father, his name was Poros, a name that means resources or resourcefulness. And his paternal grandmother was Metis, a name that means cunning or deviousness. And Eros's mother was Penia, which means poverty. So Eros is the product of heterosexual desire, born from the mingling of male and female. The feminine component is not the mere recollection or reflection of the male. It's something different. It's distinct. It's irreducible to the masculine contribution. Eros inherits the qualities of his forebears. His mother's poverty makes him poor and coarse, without charm. Diotima describes Eros as tough and shriveled and shoeless and homeless. But his father's resourcefulness and his grandmother's cunning make him brave and impetuous, intense, and a schemer. His scheme is to take possession of what he lacks, namely beauty, goodness, wisdom. By his mother's poverty, he lacks these qualities, but by his father's resourcefulness and his grandmother's cunning, he has schemes and plans to pursue them. Now, there's nothing philosophical about the gods. They don't love wisdom. They are already wise, and Socrates has just proved in his argument with Agathon, he's just proved that you don't love what you have. You only love what you lack. The gods don't lack wisdom, so they don't love wisdom, so there's nothing philosophical about it. And neither do the masses love wisdom, because they are indifferent to their own ignorance, and they care only about pleasure. Only spiritual beings love wisdom, being intermediate between the gods and the beasts and the beastly democratic mob. Eros dwells in this middle ground between the beasts and the gods. And that's also where Socrates situates the philosopher. A philosopher is a spiritual being, neither wise nor ignorant, neither completely good nor utterly bad. And Eros is a philosopher. Diotima, in this conversation, she's having a kind of a Socratic conversation with Socrates. She raises the question to the young Socrates. She asks him, what's the relation between beauty and goodness? And she asks Socrates, what have you got when you've got beauty? He can't say. He doesn't know. So she says, well, what about goodness? What have you got when you've got the good? And he answers, well, then you'd be happy. If you've got the good, you'll be happy. And so Diotima explains that beauty is the promise of that happiness, the happiness of the good. Beauty is not the good, and it's not the happiness of the good. Those are different. The good is higher than beauty, higher. But beauty is a stepping stone on the way to that good and to the happiness of the good. It's a transition to the good. It's a way station. It's a motive. It's a symbol. It's a foretaste of the good and the happiness of the good. So Diotima, we can just notice this incidentally, this speech from years ago that Socrates is bringing up now, it incidentally refutes Aristophanes from his earlier school. You remember that for Aristophanes, love is nothing but an effort to overcome the burdens of our distinctness and our separation. It's the unexamined life, par excellence. It's the life of someone who wants nothing more than to lose his mind and become one with another whom he loves. Now, on that account, from Aristophanes, offspring are irrelevant. Eros has no political dimension. It's entirely private. It's a story about two lonely people looking for some transitory comfort in a harsh world. And since that story that Aristophanes told about how we used to be joined and then we were split and we're looking for our other half, that's really just a fond fable. Really, we don't have another half, and we have no idea why we fall in love. Eros, the way that Aristophanes is presenting it, Eros is blind, irrational, it's hopeless hope, it's infinite. For Diotima, the picture is quite different. For Diotima, there's a reason why we love those whom we do. Or at least there's a reason why the philosophers love those whom we do. It's because they're searching for qualities of mind that make a good knowledge partner. People don't want anything, not even a soulmate, unless they judge it to be good. Diotima says, a vivid image, she says, people would cut off their own hands and throw them away if they thought their hands were not good. So all, she says, all the people really care about is what they believe to be good. Maybe they're wrong, but the point is that they have to believe it. What people most deeply want and love is the good. And so she says, love, eros, is wanting to possess the good forever. Now, Plato makes it clear to us that this young Socrates, when he hears this, he doesn't understand the argument. He doesn't understand the argument that she's making. He tries to follow what she says about love and beauty, but he doesn't get it. And she asks him, what is the function of Eros? He doesn't know. So she tells him that the function of Eros is to assist in pregnancy and birth. Now, what she has in mind is not as obvious as it might seem. It turns out, she explains, that every one of us, all of us, is always already pregnant. We are born pregnant. We don't need sex to make us pregnant. We need it to assist us in the process of giving birth to the new life that's already within us. We long to deliver ourselves of something beautiful, whether it be a child, or a work of art, or an idea. Pregnancy can be a matter of body or soul. Artists and philosophers are pregnant souls, and they long to give birth to beautiful work that outlives them, as a child outlives its parents. Sexual desire is not merely our natural response to beauty. It is directly creative of beauty. How is it that the spiritual, the artists, the poets, the philosophers, how is it that they give birth to beauty? Socrates, and through him, Diotima, speaks only about the philosophers. The philosopher's erotic development begins with the stimulation of the sight of a beautiful body, falls in love. It inspires him to make beautiful speeches. Here's the first case of beauty generating beauty. The sight of beauty causes the philosopher to generate something beautiful, beautiful speeches. Beauty gives rise to beauty. From falling in love with a beautiful body, the aspiring philosopher graduates to being able to appreciate the beauty in all kinds of bodies, not just the one that he's fixed on, that he's infatuated with, but begins to see how almost all bodies, maybe all bodies, maybe everything in nature is in some way beautiful. The philosopher begins to appreciate that. And then the philosopher takes a further step to appreciate the beauty of laws, the beauty of well-designed institutions, the beauty of thoughtful or important customs. And then the passion of the philosopher goes higher to appreciate the beauty of souls, the beauty of minds that may be in bodies that aren't conventionally beautiful, and desires to share knowledge with those beautiful souls and to assist them in giving birth to beautiful ideas. We see this development of the philosopher's desire rise from the beauty of one body to that of many bodies, to the beauty of abstract things like laws and institutions, and finally to the purely intellectual beauty of mind and knowledge. Philosophy itself. Each step on this ascent, each step is more beautiful, more satisfying, more rational, virtuous, a step closer to the Buddha. And at every step, it's dissatisfaction, the hint of something more and better that drives the philosopher on. A philosopher realizes the limitations of each level and follows an unfolding insight to a higher stage. Eventually, he'll catch sight of something that's more beautiful than anything else. Gautama describes it. There'll be a sudden insight, not into a beautiful thing, a beautiful person, a beautiful mind, not even a beautiful theory. Beyond that, higher than that, sudden insight into beauty itself, the very thing, not a thing that has beauty, not a separate thing that participates in beauty, but capital B, beauty itself, the very idea, the form. The philosopher catches sight of that. It's the cause of everything beautiful. It's the cause that makes all beautiful things to be beautiful. Socrates finishes his speech to great acclaim, and then something unexpected happens. All these men have been invited to Iapathon to join this party, but suddenly the doors rattle, the servants are disturbed, and a new uninvited guest bursts in through the doors. His name is Alcibiades. He's a famous Athenian nobleman, very famous. Still young, but very famous, incredibly rich, one of the richest men in all Athens, has the most famous Olympic team. Every time he enters the Olympics and the chariot races, the most prestigious event, he can afford to have the best team, always wins. He's involved in politics. He's always dogged by some kind of scandal. Maybe he did things, people are not sure. Has a very dicey reputation. On the one hand, he's beautiful. And all of Athens, they can't really resist beauty. And when someone is beautiful, they think, he can't be that bad. Look how beautiful he is. And yet, everyone knows his bad reputation. Everyone knows that he's always dabbling in scandal. Eventually, in later history, he'll go on to be a traitor to Athens in the Peloponnesian War. Anyway, he bursts into the party uninvited and stinking drunk. He's wearing a crown of violets and ivy. He bursts through the doors. He says, good evening, gentlemen. I'm plastered. May I join your party? Now, Alcibiades is, in almost every way, the opposite of Socrates. Alcibiades is beautiful on the outside, but ugly inside. Twisted, treacherous, deceptive, petty. Socrates is ugly on the outside. All of our ancient sources tell us this. He was notorious in antiquity for being ugly. He's ugly on the outside, but beautiful in spirit. Now, we learn something new about the relationship between Alcibiades and Socrates. It turns out that Alcibiades is in love with Socrates. They've been dancing around each other for years, but have never consummated their attraction. although Socrates Alcibiades strenuously tried on several occasions. Now that sort of thing being rebuffed, that didn't happen very often to Alcibiades. Usually he's the beloved and he's used to having his choice, but he's fallen for Socrates and he can't figure out why. Socrates baffles him, fascinates him, seduces him, but also mystifies him. Socrates is the strangest man that he's ever met, and the longer he knows Socrates, the stranger he becomes. Now, at this point, Alcibiades hasn't yet realized that Socrates is actually present. After all, he wasn't invited to the party. He's too drunk to be able to see clearly, so he didn't realize that Socrates was there. He's addressing Agathon. He speaks to Agathon, the host, but he doesn't even notice that right next to Agathon, that's where Socrates is sitting. As he makes his way from the door over to where Agathon is sitting, this crown of ivy that he's wearing, it drops down over his eyes, so he's even more incapacitated, and Socrates scoots over, and Alcibiades plops down between them. And then suddenly he turns, and he notices, sitting right there, Socrates. He says, "Good Lord, what's going on here? It's Socrates. You trapped me again. You're always doing that." From the others, he learns about what's been going on, about how they've been taking turns praising Eros, and they invite Alcibiades to make a speech in praise of Eros. No, he said, not him. And then someone gets the great idea, well, why don't you make a speech, instead of praising Eros, why don't you give a speech praising Socrates? Now, that's something. He agrees with pleasure, but he warns them not to expect too much. First, he's stinking drunk. Second, no one is stranger than Socrates. Alcibiades describes the effect of a conversation with Socrates. There's nothing like it. It's uncanny how Socrates makes Alcibiades feel dissatisfied with his life. Nobody does that to Alcibiades. He's not dissatisfied. He's richer than everybody. He's prettier than everybody. He always wins at the Olympics. Everybody wants to be his friend. Socrates is the only person who makes him feel dissatisfied with his love. Makes him feel like he's wasted his love. That it would be better for him to be a slave. That everything that he's done in his life has just been a big waste of time. That's how he feels when he talks to Socrates. When he's with Socrates, he feels all that really matters are the very things that he neglects, his own personal shortcomings. Socrates makes him want to examine himself, and he's not happy with what he finds. He says, "Socrates is the only man in the world who has made me feel shame." Here's more of Socrates' strangeness. On the one hand, Socrates loves beautiful boys. Alcibiades says, "Don't just listen to me, ask Socrates." They say, "Is that true, Socrates?" Socrates says, "Yeah, it's true. They just knocked me in." At the same time, he doesn't have sex with them like everybody else does. His seduction seems no more than a game to him. In fact, Alcibiades says, Socrates' whole life is one big game. He says it's a game of irony. Now, Socrates is so famous for his irony that we have a whole style or variety of irony called Socratic irony. My overhead here. In the simple case, not Socratic irony, but just simple, ordinary irony, irony is when somebody says something and it's literally false, but it implies something different, usually something opposite from what is said. So suppose that a wife says to her husband, "My mother is coming for a visit." And the husband replies without enthusiasm, "What a thrill." What's implied is not said, and what's said is literally false. That's ordinary. irony. Now, Socratic irony is a little bit different. In this case, what is said is both meant and not meant. Both serious and not serious. And what is said is true if you take it one way, but false if you take it another way. Remember Euthyphro. Euthyphro explained to Socrates how he was bringing a prosecution against his father. And Socrates says to Euthyphro, "You think that your knowledge of the divine and of piety and impiety is so accurate that you have no fear of having acted impiously in bringing your father to trial." Now, when he says that to Euthyphro, Socrates is serious and at the same time not serious. And what he implies is both true in a way and false in a way. He says to Euthyphro, "You think your knowledge of the divine is faultless." And he says, "You have no fear of having acted impiously." And all that's true. Euthyphro does think that. He does feel sure. And yet Socrates is being ironical because in the course of their conversation, it becomes quite obvious that this self-righteous fool, Euthyphro, knows nothing about piety and knows nothing about himself at all. Well, back to Alcibiades. Alcibiades recounts his series of humiliating attempts, multiple attempts, all failures, to seduce Socrates. First, having observed how Socrates is passionate about pretty boys, Alcibiades figures that he can get what he wants from Socrates by letting Socrates seduce him. But what Alcibiades wants is not sex, but philosophical instruction and wisdom. His plan is to make a trade. He's confident that the plan will work because there's not a man in Athens who doesn't want to have sex with Alcibiades. And Socrates is a notorious flirt with the boys, so it's obvious. He invites Socrates to wrestle with him in the gym. You know, of course, that Greek wrestling is performed naked. Doesn't work. Next, Alcibiades tries to get Socrates drunk, though, as he tells us in the symposium, he says, "Socrates drinks as much as anybody, but no one has ever seen Socrates actually inebriated. Nobody's ever seen him actually drunk, but he'll drink every cup with you." Anyway, they plan to spend a night together, to have an evening drinking together. Alcibiades invites him to his palace to drink and talk. And then it gets late, and Alcibiades invites him to lie down, and then he lies down next to him and waits for him to make his move. Nothing happens. Now, these unsuccessful seductions, they haven't turned Alcibiades off. If anything, they've inflamed his passion. Now, that's what's so strange to Alcibiades. Socrates comes on to you, making like he's in love with you, so you flirt a bit and talk a bit and think you're in control, and then suddenly, it's you who unexpectedly find yourself falling in love with him. Socrates is ironic even in love affairs. He ironically pretends to be in love until the other person falls in love with him. Now, Alcibiades has a fantastically superficial understanding of Socrates and of the Socratic conception of wisdom, for him to think that he could get it from Socrates in exchange for sex. At one level, Alcibiades must hate Socrates, even if he's in love with him, because Socrates just repeatedly forces him to confront everything that's disgraceful about himself. How can that be fun? But it's not mere coyness for Socrates to hold out. Socrates cannot teach anyone anything that they don't already know. All that he can do is ask questions and try to draw out what you already know but haven't yet really reflected upon. Realize that you knew all along. Alcibiades knows so little He's so unpracticed in self-examination that he frankly is not attractive to Socrates as a disciple. A disciple is one in whom the teacher can plant the seed of great ideas. Alcibiades is not that kind of soil. He's much too rough beneath the all-too-smooth surface. And yet he knows himself well enough to know that he loves Socrates, despite all the rebuffs, still loves him even more. He sees just enough of the truth to be drawn to Socrates despite all these rebuffs. A worse man would hate Socrates. But Alcibiades can't shake him off. Now that's probably the best thing about Alcibiades. It's a sign that maybe even he could be redeemed by philosophy. He's beginning to glimpse a beauty that's higher than that of the body, whose pleasures are all too familiar. If he could stick with it, work on himself, learn to care about his soul, he might one day become a philosopher. In the end, though, it would never happen. After this speech by Alcibiades, the party gets crashed by yet more rowdy drunks. Some of the people leave, others fall asleep. Eurysimachus fell asleep, and then he wakes himself up the next morning. He starts to leave the house of Agathon. On his way out, he looks over and he sees Socrates and Agathon and Aristophanes still going at it, sitting at a table, sharing a cup of wine, still arguing philosophy. It turns out we've got Agathon, the tragic poet, Aristophanes, the comic poet. There's Socrates between them saying, it ought to be possible, he's trying to persuade them, it ought to be possible for the same poet to write both tragedies and comedies. That was not the way in Athens. And these two opposite poets, they're arguing, saying, no, it won't work, it couldn't happen. And Socrates is arguing with them about that. And then eventually, even those two pass out. And there's nobody left but Socrates. So he puts down the glass of wine that he's been drinking, picks himself up, shakes off his clothes, and heads off to the gym. He'll have a bath and start a new day. That's all that I want to say about the symposium. What's going to happen now is we've got some time. Please don't start getting noisy. I'm going to ask if there's any questions or comments or things people want to bring up about the symposium or anything else we're going to be talking about. Looking ahead to next week, we've got just a little bit more Plato. I want to talk about a much later work of Plato's, The Republic. It's a big, big book. We could easily spend the whole year on looking at this book. But we're just going to take a look at a little part of it, get a little bit of an insight into some of the theories that Plato developed after he became a more mature and independent philosopher and stopped just trying to tell people what Socrates was. Also, this weekend, I'll be preparing the first writing assignment. You'll see from the syllabus that I'll be posting this on the Avenue page on Monday. So let me see if there's any questions or comments, things people want to make about what we've been doing, what we're going to be doing. Yes.
When you said that Alcibiades falls for Socrates, you meant that sexually or because he wanted philosophical?